Okay, the next matter is case number 20-0909, Maynor versus Maxwell. Counsel, please approach.
Good morning.
Good morning. As soon as you're ready.
Okay. Judge Pirtle, Judge Welch, and Judge Arterburn.
He's going to participate on briefs.
On briefs. Okay. Very good. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. My name is Terry Barber. I represent Mark Maynor, who is the who commenced this action, which is a professional negligence action, early in 2019. I joined the case in the fall of 2019. And we're here this morning because a summary judgment was granted in the case by the district court last fall. The summary that was done of this case shows that the issues are that Maynor is maintaining are, first of all, whether the judge erred in not recusing himself or stepping aside in the case, whether the judge erred in dismissing Mr. Fansteel from the case. And then there were a couple of issues with the summary judgment itself. One was with the matter of whether it should have been deferred because of some reasons suggested by Mr. Maynor's expert, Judge Burns, and then whether there were material issues of fact. Now, a few weeks ago, there was another spoke added to the wheel when y'all entered an order suggesting that we had a standing problem and asked us to counsel to supply supplemental briefs, which we all did. Now, I think that the parties don't agree on a lot of things in this case, but one thing that there is agreement about is that the issue being suggested is a matter of the real party and interest status of Mr. Maynor in his individual capacity. And we've briefed that issue. In addition, on behalf of the plaintiff's side of the case, I filed a motion. I followed the supplemental brief with a motion requesting leave to amend with regard to parties to solve any issue that lingered.
What authority do you have to do that at this stage of the proceedings?
Well, Your Honor, the statute that I rely on, and I believe it's cited both in the supplemental brief and the motion that was filed, is 25301. And 25301 says that every action shall be prosecuted in the name of the real party in interest, except as otherwise provided in 25304. And I don't think that has an application to this case. An action, and again, it's not referring to parties, it's referring to the action, shall not be dismissed on the ground that it is not prosecuted in the name of the real party in interest until a reasonable time has been allowed after objection for joinder or substitution of the real party in interest. So, based on that statute, and statutes I think we regard as a legislative mandate as to how things are supposed to be done, it indicates that this is not limited to the county court, the district court, any other specific court level with respect to the issue with respect to the need for the real party and interest.
Let me interrupt you for a second. If the district court, though, didn't have jurisdiction at the time they heard the case, and we don't have jurisdiction now, even if you were to amend at this stage, how does that fix what the court did when it didn't have jurisdiction? You amending it retroactive to the beginning of the case?
Well, at least on behalf of Mr. Maxell, as I recall, Mr. Fansteel was out of the case pretty early, at the end of 6 months from when the case was filed and so forth. But in the answer that was filed on behalf of Maxell and some others, they, I believe, pled an affirmative defense of a real party in interest that Mentor was not. But that was.
Let me just ask you a couple of questions. So you agree that Mr. Maynor attempted to bring this action as the sole surviving beneficiary of the trust. So his standing to bring this claim for malpractice is the sole surviving beneficiary, correct?
That's right.
Okay. And so the court has already set out that unless the trustee refuses to do that, or if you have a special duty, you can't bring it in that capacity. None of that stuff is alleged here, how he had a capacity to bring the suit, correct? In his role as the sole beneficiary of the trust, when the representation here was in connection with the trust. Would you agree with that?
There is no allegation setting out that he asked the trustee to start the action and the trustee refused.
Right.
I will concede that. It's just not there. I think that in both the complaint and the amended complaint, he talked about being the sole beneficiary, and he also talked about being an individual in Douglas County, Nebraska. And so that there's actually a couple of capacities that he's talking about in his pleading. As well, if you hearken back and take a look at Exhibit 1, which is Mr. Krause's affidavit in which he shows all of the background of these cases, one of the things that you will find there, excuse me, in the particular citation is in the brief, is that the cases about which Mr. Maynor is complaining,
the U.S. Bank,
in those cases, he was one of the parties.
But in the U.S. Bank case, he was named as a plaintiff in the capacity as the attorney in fact for the trust. Correct.
But he was also named individually
in that capacity. It's pled in there. And also the beneficiaries are listed in there as being the grandchildren, not him. Agreed?
That's true.
And the property was held by the trust as it related to those cases, correct?
Yes, it was.
And didn't he in fact plead that Raymond Maynor at the time of the filing was now the owner of title to that property?
Now, are you talking about the U.S. Bank case?
U.S. Bank case, which is where all this litigation is about.
Back in 2014.
Right.
Yes.
So there's nothing in this pleading that tells us where the property is now. If it was in Mr. Maynor's hands, how in the world is he the sole beneficiary of this trust, have standing and the real party in interest to bring this case?
Your Honor, for the purpose of this argument, at this point, I'm going to concede that he doesn't have standing. But I am going to urge the court to work with me to fix this, because the statute 25301 requires that.
Okay.
Now, whether we substitute the party at this point, there isn't anything to say that we cannot suspend the progress in this case without it being submitted while the matter of substitution of party is properly handled. At the time that I made the motion, my understanding was not only was Mr. Maynor at that time the sole beneficiary of the trust, but he had also been designated as the sole trustee of the trust. I found out yesterday afternoon that he does not have a document making him the trustee. And as I understand, his wife, Andrea, is actually the trustee of the trust. Now, under 25301, strictly speaking, the proper thing is for Andrea at this point to be the party plaintiff. And it's a matter that, according to the statute, needs to be solved. And I think that what this statute is saying is that some reasonable allowance is expected for the plaintiff's side of this case to be able to accomplish that.
Is there a Nebraska case that says that we would have the ability to do that at this stage of the proceedings?
I am not aware of one. I am aware that the two cases, the Pittman case and the school boundary case, I forget the name of it, that are referenced by both Mr. Fansteel's lawyer and Mr. Maxell's lawyer, are inapposite. One of them is an intervention case, and one of them is a mistake on the defendant's side as opposed to the plaintiff's side. I don't think they control anything. The closest I can find is the Rice v. Adam case, which is cited in the brief. But again, that isn't on point, Judge Pirtle, with what you're talking about, because that matter came up at the district court level, and it was a bankruptcy trustee as opposed to the individual. So as far as I can tell, we're kind of on new territory here.
Okay, and you're asking us to look at 25301 as it relates to the vehicle by which that would.
That's right. 25301, Your Honor, may I approach?
Sure.
That's the statute to which I've made reference with its annotations from the Nebraska statutes. It's current as of, I think that one was printed yesterday.
Okay.
So.
And your time has expired. So appreciate it. We understand your position though. Thank you.
Okay.
A technical point, Your Honors, are Mr. Green and I splitting our 10 minutes, or do we?
You can allocate it however the two of you would like. So
you have 10 minutes to divide.
Exactly.
Understood.
Oh, do you want to designate that up front so that we know, or? Okay. 8-2.
Thank you. May it please the court, Your Honors. Ryan Frouse from Cassam Tierney on behalf of all of the defendants other than Mr. Fansteel. It's represented by Mr. Green. I believe Your Honors are either the 9th or the 10th set of judges or judges who have had a chance to look at the facts of this underlying case. This has been litigation that's been going on for 11 years, and it's now resulted in this malpractice or an attempt at a malpractice action. It did not come as a surprise to me at all that this court was more perceptive than was I in coming up with this question of standing. I had actually raised that in the county court version, one of the 9 prior actions in this chain, and raised it successfully. Frankly, by the time we got to the district court on the malpractice action, we had so many defenses to deal with that it simply slipped my mind to deal with this one. I think at this point, the question of standing a real party in interest has essentially been conceded by the plaintiff appellant, as well it should be. I believe the motion to substitute at this late date or to change the status of Mark Maynor to enable him in some fashion to be able to seek to recover for the trust as opposed to recovering for whatever individual damage he might have is clearly out of time, is too late. I think Mr. Barber acknowledged there's absolutely no Nebraska authority that would support substituting a party or changing the status of a party for the first time on appeal. The law is pretty clear that you have to either be the trustee Mark Maynor is neither the trustee nor is he even a successor trustee.
Well, and I'll ask you the same question because I'm trying to think of the logic of it. For us to change the parties at this point and confer jurisdiction at this point, the district court didn't have jurisdiction when they heard it, so it wouldn't.
And had no opportunity to even deal with the question.
Right, so I don't know what we could do at the appellate level as it relates to his request.
I don't believe you can, and I think at this point it's too late to do anything about it. And there's absolutely no authority that would allow that at this point. On the more substantive issues, clearly Judge Coffey was correct in granting this motion for summary judgment. There was a request for a continuance, and there was a request for a continuance to go back and look and re-adjudicate a case that had now been closed for 4 years. The request for continuance was also made at a time that the plaintiff's expert had been identified for 11 months. The defense had identified their expert for over 7. There was absolutely no need at that point for a continuance, and Judge Coffey rightly determined that we could get on with the question of summary judgment. Beyond that,
what was the basis of the request for continuance?
I believe what the plaintiff appellant wanted to do was to go back and question whether or not Judge Bowie's decision had dealt with all aspects of the case.
So whether it was a final order or not?
Exactly.
Okay.
And interestingly, if that was not a final order, I'm here defending a malpractice action that resulted from supposed negligence in maintaining the appeal from that action. If we're going back to square one, we're not here today. Beyond that, if we reach, and again, when we're talking about concessions or admissions, the fact that that motion for a continuance was made at that late date before the district court is another concession that the plaintiff at that point could not meet the evidence that we had produced in favor of the motion for summary judgment.
So in that regard, on the motion for summary judgment proffered an expert by it, as it related to both the U.S. Bank case and the REO case, and said that there was no malpractice and no proximate cause as it relates to
across the board
statement.
Across the board, yes. We, in support of the motion, offered the affidavit and report of John Walker from the Lamson Dugan firm. And Mr. Walker, at great length, reviewed the various cases, the various actions taken by counsel, and averred that there was no breach of the standard in any regard. In opposition to that, what the plaintiff appellant offered was first a report by retired Judge Stephen Burns. And in that report, Judge Burns expressly notes that he expresses no opinion, I'm quoting, on the standard of care or the breach of the standard of care by any attorney or firm involved.
His opinion is if they would have properly perfected the appeal and gone the distance, it would have been reversed because it wasn't a final order, not because there was malpractice.
That was his point. That was his point at that time, yes. Expressed no opinion on the standard of care. That left them with either Mr. Van Steele's scant testimony on the subject and his deposition.
But why doesn't that do it? Why doesn't that create a fact question? If Mr. Van Steele acknowledged that he didn't properly perfect that appeal, you say perfect, didn't request a bill of exceptions, didn't file a brief, wasn't that sufficient to create a factual question as it relates to the issue of standard of care?
I don't believe it was a question of outcome dispositive fact. In fact, as relates to my defendants, first of all, when we come to the question of a bill of exceptions, and there are really only two things they talk about. One is the absence of a bill of exceptions. Judge Bowie decided this on the basis of the law. There was nothing in the exhibits which were offered to the district court which were going to alter that decision on the law. On appeal, if Judge Bowie was not incorrect on the law, nothing in a bill of exceptions, had it been put together, would have altered that.
What about not filing a brief? not briefing it, isn't that resolving?
The brief, as a matter of fact, my clients, and I know Mr. Green's going to deal with the fact that there wasn't service. But my defendants in this case were fired where time still remained to submit a brief. And in fact, Mr. Fansteel entered an appearance then, and Mr. Fansteel was much more intimately familiar with the underlying facts of this case. He then entered his appearance and actually filed a motion for yet another extension before that brief date hit. So I guess that would be my response to that, Your Honor. Bottom line, Judge Coffey also ruled that Mr. Fansteel could not be forced to be an expert in this case, and that was never assigned as error on this appeal. When we get to the question of proximate cause, this was brought 4 times in the underlying case in state court. It was brought once in bankruptcy court. It was brought once before Judge Rossiter in the U.S. District Court in a case in which Judge Rossiter actually sanctioned the plaintiff, Mr. Maynard, and his attorney at that time, Mr. Fansteel, for even bringing this case again.
That was the U.S. Bank Federal Court case, right?
Yes, it was, Your Honor. And at that point, I'll relinquish the rest of my time.
Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Judge Welch, Judge Pirtle.
Morning.
Morning.
Ready, go. I would note at the outset of Mr. Barber's comments to the court that he stated one of the basis of this appeal was the fact that Judge Coffey dismissed Mr. Fansteel from the case. That's just flat out an incorrect statement. Judge Coffey did not dismiss Mr. Fansteel. Nebraska Statute 25217 dismissed that case. Service was not had within 6 months of the date of filing of the amended complaint. 25217 is a self-executing statute. There was nothing Judge Coffey had to do after the expiration of that 6-month time period to make that dismissal effective. He did enter an order of dismissal, but it wasn't some subjective or opinion of his that the case should be dismissed. It was dismissed as a matter of law. And from that point on, the trial court had no further jurisdiction over Mr. Fansteel in that case. And as I look back on the case, and I wasn't in it at the time, but the motion to reconsider and the motion to vacate filed by the appellant's counsel probably shouldn't even been heard by Judge Coffey, because there was no case at that point in time against Mr. Fansteel. The case had been dismissed by statute. It was gone. And there's nothing that can take place at this point to bring that case back once it was dismissed by statute. Now, we've laid that all out in our brief, how 25217 applies in this case. And we're going to have to rely on that, because I had rebuttal points on the plaintiff's brief or the appellant's reply brief, but I see I'm out of time. So thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Counsel, thank you both. The matter is taken under advisement.